All right, so we're going to dive into 1 Corinthians a bit and try to get you guys, get us all kind of headed in the same direction on this. So I'm going to start off saying something that I know is kind of bold, extreme, biased, and probably wrong, which is a great way to start this off. But I think, as I was thinking today about this, I think 1 Corinthians might be the most important book in the New Testament. Which I know we shouldn't even say that, but I really do kind of think that. As I think back on my life as a Christian, my life as a pastor, this book keeps popping up. It kind of like some of the biggest breakthroughs I've had in my life, some of the loudest debates I've had have been centered around some of the stuff in this book. And just for a moment, just imagine if we didn't have 1 Corinthians in our Bibles. Just for a minute, just think about that. We would lose some of the most definitive treatment in the whole Bible concerning sex, singleness, marriage and divorce, church discipline, church leadership, spiritual gifts, the resurrection, the Lord's Supper, the Holy Spirit. Like literally, I have no idea how we would have any vision for Sunday mornings at all if it wasn't for 1 Corinthians. Like Paul spends so much time in there. The breadth of this letter is just astounding. One of the most amazing things about 1 Corinthians is that even though it's one of the most contextualized books in the whole Bible, it's very specific to the Corinthian church, addressing topics today that are almost foreign to us. In the same way, it speaks directly to some of the biggest issues that we face today. Which again, I think probably points to the fact that those are connected, right? We don't always see them as that way, but they're connected. And what's beautiful too about this letter is how it's a letter written out of brokenness. Like it's a letter that comes from a church that is completely jacked up. We're going to get into some of that, but it's completely jacked up. It's a kind of church that we couldn't even envision being called a Christian church. And yet Paul is writing to them as a father who cares for them, who loves them, who sometimes like a father is fighting for them by correcting them, by trying to reach them in some way. So let's talk about Corinth for just a minute. So Corinth was this Roman colony. It held this strategic importance because of its location. It was basically this major port city for international trade and had become one of the wealthiest cities in all of Greece. And so by Paul's day, Corinth had grown into this bustling cosmopolitan where there were merchants and tourists from all over the Roman Empire. I mean, it even held one of the most important sporting events in the world, second only to the Olympics. And here's kind of the point. Corinth was not just some village you passed through. It was a destination. And as one commentator kind of put it, Corinth was like the New York, LA, and Vegas of the ancient world all wrapped up in one. And just like any other large city that has tons of people flowing through it, Corinth was known, had a reputation for its vices, and in particular was known for sex. That's what it was known for. In fact, one ancient author coined this Greek term, Corinthiazo, which means to act like a Corinthian, which he used as a way to mean to fornicate. Like, that was kind of his, like, slang way of saying that. In other words, what happens in Corinth stays in Corinth. It's the kind of place that you talk to your coworkers and say you visited Corinth with kind of a wink and a nod, and they know what that means, right? That was the kind of reputation that the city had. But also, in the same breath, Corinth was a deeply spiritual place. It was a religious place. They had all kinds of temples littered throughout Corinth on every street corner. Like there were several to the goddess Aphrodite. Worshippers would come from all over. They would make pilgrimages to these temples to worship there. And while temple prostitution wasn't as widespread in Paul's day, it wouldn't be unusual for Corinthians to hold some sort of feasts at these temples that involved sexual play, that involved orgies, that involved things of that nature. It was a place where sexual promiscuity and spiritual vitality, they weren't seen as enemies. They weren't seen as opposed to each other in any way whatsoever. And out of this city, the Corinthian church was born. This is kind of the birthplace, the culture that the Corinthians kind of grew up in. And this was one of the many churches that Paul had planted on his journeys. And as I said before, he saw himself as their father. And he mentions that a few times in this letter. He saw themselves as their father. And we actually get to read about Corinth getting planted in Acts 18. And in Acts 18, we read that Paul, he started this church, and he actually spent quite a bit of time there. He stayed there for a year and a half. And one of the reasons why is because God actually spoke to him. Corinth is a place where God said, hey, keep speaking the gospel here because I have many people in this city. So stay here and keep speaking the gospel, which, as just a side note, just again, think of the Lord's kindness that in this kind of place, God places Paul and says, stay there, labor there. There are so many people here who are my people. They just don't know it yet, but they're mine. And so during this time, Paul, he stays, he preaches the gospel. Gentiles, many Gentiles are flocking to Jesus. A few influential Jews are also coming to know Jesus. But then after some time, as always kind of happens, persecution breaks out against Paul, and he ends up leaving, which, again, as kind of a side note, you can't help but wonder how the Corinthians kind of thought of Paul after that point. Maybe gives a little bit of context to, it seems like they accuse him of being weak, right? Probably gives a little bit of context behind that. But eventually Apollos comes in after being instructed by Priscilla and Aquila and minister to Corinth in Paul's stead. But here's kind of where we're at. By the time this letter is written, several years after this, this church was a hot mess. It was a hot mess. It had begun to resemble the way of Corinth more than it resembled the way of Jesus. And so the way that they used to live, their previous life that they had, was still whispering to their hearts and was creeping in unnoticed. And they were trying to figure out how to kind of reconcile the way of Corinth with the way of Jesus. How to live the way that they used to, but with Jesus kind of added to the mix. And just to give you a glimpse of this church, here are just some of the issues that Paul addresses in his letter. And keep in mind, I doubt this is every issue they had. Like, there's only so much space. There's only so many things you can address. But here's some of the things. Boasting in their spiritual superiority. Celebrating a man's sexual relationship with his stepmother. Suing one another over trivial disputes, pursuing sexual abstinence within marriage, or getting divorced from their spouse to attain spiritual superiority, justifying the use of prostitutes, probably a result of the last issue, feasting at pagan temples and eating the sacrifices made there, neglecting poor members of the church and getting drunk on the Lord's Supper, believing that the gift of tongues was a sign of spiritual superiority. They had chaotic worship services. So in other words, everyone's speaking at tongues all at once without interpretation. Everyone's open to share whatever they want, whenever they want in a church service. They have simultaneous ecstatic prophecies going on in different areas of the church. And there's just constant interruptions of people asking questions or doing different stuff. It's just chaotic. People were getting baptized on behalf of the dead, and they were denying the resurrection of the dead. So I know that every church is a mess, but this is a different level of jacked up. Like, this is, I mean, can you imagine writing to a church like this? I feel like if it was me, I would have just sent the Michael Jordan, stop it, get some help meme, and just walked away, right? How do you even start addressing a church like that? What issue do you even focus on first? My goodness. But here's the deal. Paul loves this church too much to just say, try harder, I'll check on you next year. And God loves this church too much to leave them there, which is why Paul begins this letter not with condemnation, but with thanksgiving. Like, it's still astounding, and I know, I feel like you know, any series that starts, I hear maybe on Corinthians, I hear a sermon on this, it's out there, but it's still so impactful that Paul starts out his letter with, I give thanks to my God always for you because of the grace of God that was given to you in Christ Jesus. He affirms them. He thanks God for them, even though they are so messed up. As with little children, Paul is patiently dealing with them throughout the letter. And I think one of the things that's amazing about this letter is Paul thoughtfully and wisely points them in the right direction. Like, even with things like sleeping with prostitutes, Paul doesn't go, stop doing that. Paul gives a detailed, theological, well-thought-out argument as to why they should stop doing that. Like, he's just so thoughtful and caring and directing and doing things that you wouldn't expect to do because he cares and loves this church. And so when reading 1 Corinthians, there's a bit of a challenge in this. And one of the challenges is that 1 Corinthians, this letter's a bit like walking into a room where someone's on the phone. And so you already miss like part of the conversation. And even now, you're only hearing one side of the conversation. So you can kind of make out what they're saying, but you don't really know until after they hang up and you go, hey, what were you talking about again? And that's kind of like how 1 Corinthians is. As confusing as it sounds, 1 Corinthians is not the first letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. So we actually find out in chapter 5 that Paul wrote a previous letter that we don't have access to. And we don't know exactly what he said. But it seems like he included some sort of correction to them, for instance, telling them to stop sleeping around. But between that letter and this letter, two other things have kind of happened that's important. First, the Corinthians actually wrote Paul back. So the Corinthians wrote a letter back to Paul, and it wasn't good. It wasn't good. They essentially justified their behavior wrapped up in uber spiritual language. So they kind of defended their wayward practices, leaning heavily on the wisdom that they kind of had in their spiritualized state. They leaned on the freedom they have in Christ. So Paul quotes, it seems like kind of their mantra of all things are lawful for me. He kind of quotes that back to them a few times. That's something they probably said over and over again. Hey, it's all lawful for me. We can do this. And it seems that at least some of the people in Corinth were now standing directly opposed to Paul and his teaching. And in fact, from some of the ways that Paul responds, it seems like they thought of him as unspiritual. They thought of him as unenlightened. They thought of him as weak. In essence, they were kind of like, Paul, you're basic. That's kind of what they were saying to him in that letter. But the second thing that happened, besides this letter going, Paul actually has some people who come and report to him some things that are going on in Corinth that he didn't even know about yet, further just confirming their brokenness. So he hears about divisions going on, especially during the Lord's Supper. He heard about incest that's happening, that's being celebrated in the church. He heard about these lawsuits that are happening between members of the church. And so this letter of 1 Corinthians is Paul's response back to them. So this is the second letter he's now writing to them. And he spends the first chunk of the letter mostly responding to the reports he had. So he says a lot of like, I hear this is going on among you. I hear this is happening among you. The people are telling me that this is what is going on. And in that first part, he particularly defends his own authority over them and kind of impels them to once again see him as their father. But then in the latter half of the letter, he kind of goes through and takes a more direct approach, arguing almost point by point, line by line with their letter. Obviously, we don't get everything that they said, he spends a lot of time quoting from them and then giving his counterpoint. And here's kind of an important thing. Sometimes this part of the letter is framed up as like this innocent Q&A where the Corinthians were like, hey, here's some questions. Can you help us out? But it doesn't seem like that's actually what's happening. The quotes that Paul quote are bold assertions that they're making. It's their defenses, them saying, here's why it's okay for us to be doing this. And so Paul is kind of quoting from them. He's kind of like doing the thing where you go like, hey, in your email, you said this. Let me tell you why that's wrong. He's kind of doing that kind of thing. He quotes and then kind of gives his counterpoints in there and shows how their theology stands opposed to the gospel. Now, there's a couple things that they believe that fed into this, the way that they were behaving. And it seems like there was a growing faction in the Corinthian church that, along with the other Corinthians, they were deeply influenced by Greek and pagan thought. And there's two things I want you to see that kind of feed into everything that they end up wrestling with. So the first thing is dualism. Dualism. So being influenced by Platonic kind of philosophy, the Corinthians as a whole believed that the body and the soul were these two distinct and disconnected realities. And in particular, they stress that the superiority of what's spiritual over what's physical, right? And so for them, the body kind of weighed you down with its passions and desires and weaknesses. And the best that you could do is kind of just satisfy those desires and kind of deal with them that way until our true self, our spiritual self, is liberated from this body. And here's why that matters. What they began to see was what we do in our physical bodies is disconnected from and has no impact on our spiritual lives. These are two separate things. And as you can imagine, this influenced the way they thought about ethics and morality, and in particular, the way that they thought about sex. And so to them, I mean, Paul even kind of quotes this in 1 Corinthians 6, just like we eat to satisfy this desire of hunger, sex is merely satisfying appetites. That's what it is. Like, we have this desire in our physical bodies, so now we're going to satisfy that, whether that's through a prostitute, another kind of relationship. And sure, it'd be great to be freed from the physical body and its desires, but kind of the thought was, if we have these desires, let's satisfy them. And what matters most is not even what we do in our body. What matters is what we do inside in our spirits, our spiritual life. That's what matters. And so you have this disconnect where literally it's like you have these people who think they're super spiritual, and yet they're going sleeping around with whoever. And they're just like, well, the body was made, like, body was made for sex. Body was made to eat. Body has these desires. We seem to satisfy them until we're freed from this body. And in the same line of thought, they rejected the idea that our physical bodies would be raised from the dead. Right? So Paul spends a lot of time on this. It's almost like kind of like the climax of the letter. But the idea of our bodies being raised from the dead was contrary to kind of this dualism that they held onto. And so for them, the body didn't have any inherent value. It was like a prison for our spiritual self. And so so they might say things like, hey, isn't this life just trying to free ourselves from what's earthly? Aren't we just trying to liberate ourselves from the natural? Like, God has given us the spirit and made us spiritual. So for them, the ideal was to be freed from the physical forever and not to come again under its bondage. Now, I think this is really important because even though we don't lay these things out similar to like a Greek philosophy, we too have a really jacked up understanding of the body. We tend to think of the body as a shell of ourselves, instead of seeing the body as actually a part of who you are. Like, your body was given to you by God, and your body matters so much that God is going to raise it. You will forever live with a body. You're not going to just be floating around forever. God gave you a body. He desires you to have a body. And the physical is actually really important. Okay, second thing. So besides dualism, the second thing that you kind of see glittered throughout everything is they have this spiritualized eschatology. The spiritualized eschatology. I'll explain what I mean by that. here's kind of the point. So where are we headed? Like, what is the point of all of this? What is the goal of the Christian life? For the Corinthians, well, first, for the Christians, we look forward to the return of Jesus. We look to that day when he's going to come back. He's going to set all things right, right? He's going to restore, he's going to rule over all of the earth as king in a new heavens and new earth. But for the Corinthians, they took those ideas and they spiritualized them. Okay? So the goal was not some future eternal state, but their current enlightened spiritual state. So they might have said things like, resurrection? Like, what do you think the Spirit did when he saved us? Like, we're the resurrection. We live in that now. Or they might have said things like, hey, you're waiting for the new heavens and new earth. Like, we're living the new heavens and new earth. Like, we're experiencing that now. Like, you're missing out. And they had reached this wisdom and knowledge and looked down on others like Paul, who hadn't been enlightened as they were. In essence, they had moved on from the milk of Paul's teaching, right? They kind of looked at that and was like, that's child's play. They thought they had already attained this heightened spiritual state such that Paul, he goes on in 1 Corinthians 4 and he says, already you have all you want. He's being sarcastic here. Already you've become rich. Without us, you've become kings. They thought they had it. And because of this, they sought to live in that spiritualized eschatological state here and now. So, for instance, misinterpreting Jesus in Luke 20, where Jesus talks about how when in the new heavens and new earth, we're not going to be married. We're going to be like angels. Some of them sought to divorce their spouses so they could live as angels who neither marry nor are given in marriage. They're like, hey, we're living in the then now, so let's embrace that. This also might explain some of their overemphasis on the gift of tongues, especially when Paul talks about them being like they were speaking in the tongues of angels. Maybe they saw that as like, hey, we're speaking as angels. We moved on. We've attained this state of high spirituality. So Paul combats this thinking with a few big ideas, and then we're going to wrap up after this. So the first thing, Paul corrects them in their eschatology. This book, 1 Corinthians, is filled with eschatological language. In fact, the whole theology of the book, in my opinion, is centered around that eschatology, centered around the end, what is going to happen in the future. His introduction, his conclusion, they both have these different references to the end and Jesus's return. And Paul makes every effort to correct their kind of spiritualized eschatology that they have. And so in every topic that he addresses, pretty much, except for head coverings, but in every other one, he makes an eschatological argument for it in every single topic. For instance, when addressing lawsuits and where Christians were going and bringing lawsuits to the pagans to judge between them, he argues that doing so goes against the eschatological truth that Christians will judge the world. Like, you see how he just makes it so heavy and weighty? I mean, listen to this. He says, do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more than matters pertaining to this life? First of all, no, I didn't know all of that, Paul. Thank you for filling me in. I don't even know what that means. But second, if I was Paul, this would be the last argument I would be making. I would be saying, hey, love one another, don't sue one another. Right? But Paul doesn't do that. He takes these seemingly simple behavioral matters and he ties them to this high stakes eschatological truth. He makes it so weighty on them. And I think here's the point, though. Our eschatology, what we believe, like where we believe we are headed, matters. It matters. It actually affects how we live now. And we fool ourselves when we think that it doesn't. The Corinthians had this misunderstanding, this misguided belief about where they were headed, about the spiritual state that they had attained, all of that stuff. And it manifested itself out in a number of different ways. Like Paul, the reason he brings the weighty thing in is he's like seeing the deeper thing under the deeper thing under the deeper thing. If we see the end rightly, if we see where we're headed rightly, who Jesus is, what he is doing, we actually will see right now rightly too. We'll see the present rightly. What we believe in the end actually deeply matters and affects us. So the second thing is Paul corrects their ecclesiology, so their ideas about the church. Paul spends a lot of time kind of correcting how we think about the church. So in the very beginning, he gives one of the clearest definitions of what it means to be in the church, right? He talks about them being these saints called by God. But he goes on, he argues for the unity of the church. He helps us think rightly about church leadership and our relationship to them. He captures for us theological metaphors of the church, such as the temple and the body. He presses into those. We learn about church discipline and even get a nod at the end towards giving. Like, we get the clearest instructions on church practices and the exercise of spiritual gifts in the corporate setting in this letter. I mean, as I said before, we'd have no idea how to have a Sunday service without 1 Corinthians. And here's the point. The Corinthians had taken their eyes off of God's vision for the church. They had taken their eyes off of that. And Paul is encouraging them and wanting them and us to think deeply about who God has made us as the church, as the people of God. So, second thing, ecclesiology. Third thing is ethics. So he corrects their ethics, how they're actually living, which is kind of like, I don't know, no-brainer, duh, because of all the things that he's having to address with them. But again, I want you to understand this. He never simply says, never says, stop doing that. He never says that. And in fact, a lot of times, here's what he does. He draws the tension between who we are and how we are living. So in the beginning, to a church that is drowning in its own brokenness, he addresses them as saints and sanctified. Later on, he says this, and it's powerful when you really catch it in 1 Corinthians 5, talking about this church discipline situation going on. He says, cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. So he's saying, hey, there's this brokenness inside the church. You got to get rid of that so you can be unleavened, because you are unleavened. Like, you actually are clean. You are washed. You are sanctified. Now live into that truth. Live into who you really are. I mean, 1 Corinthians 6, he lists off the list. Here were the things. Such were some of you, but you've been washed. You have been sanctified. You've been made clean. So don't go back to those things. He stresses that as followers of Jesus, there is a way to live. Our behavior matters. It actually matters. The Corinthians had fallen back into the way of Corinth, and they didn't just need to hear a list of rules. They needed to remember who they were. So Paul tries to help them do that. The fourth thing that Paul kind of hits on is he focuses on what true wisdom is. True wisdom. Now, 1 Corinthians, this kind of surprised me as I was reading through it, but the first three chapters references wisdom more than any other book in the New Testament. And in fact, more than all the rest of the Bible outside wisdom literature and outside the narrative of Solomon. So it talks about wisdom quite a bit. And it's probably due to the Corinthians' obsession with wisdom, right? With Greek philosophy. And it seems implied that they thought Paul lacked wisdom because he didn't think like they did. And Paul flips everything upside down on them. Like when you start realizing this, you see how snarky Paul is, especially in the beginning of this letter. He is just like basically calling them kids. I mean, he is just blasting them. But one of the things he points out is, again, they're walking around thinking, man, I've really embraced wisdom. Like I've really moved on from Paul's teaching. Like we really got this. And Paul, in the midst of that, goes, true wisdom is actually folly. It's actually folly to the world. God's wisdom is that we can't know God through wisdom. Like, you can't, but only through folly. Like, that's his wisdom. And then Paul, he lets him in on a little secret. I love this in chapter 2, where he says, hey, you know what? We actually do impart this secret wisdom. Like, you want to know what it is? God's love that he's revealed to us in Jesus. Like, that's the secret. That's the wisdom you're looking for. That's what true wisdom is. Not moving beyond what Jesus himself taught. The fifth thing, and I kind of already talked about this a little bit, but the importance of the body. The importance of the body. Paul shows the value, both the spiritual and the physical, for the Christian. And so in response to their dualism, he teaches the importance of the body. And just listen to this. I'm going to read it. This is, as I was reading through this letter, this was one of the most powerful sections in chapter 6. Listen to what he says. He says, the body is not meant for sexual morality, but for the Lord. And the Lord for the body. What does that even mean? And God raised up the Lord and will raise us up by his power. Now listen to this. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Do you think of your body as a member of Jesus? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. So we're to glorify God in our bodies. Our bodies are important. They belong to Jesus. And though we die, the body is so significant, God's going to raise it up. What we do in our body matters. And the last thing he talks about is what is truly spiritual. What is truly spiritual? Paul doesn't jettison spiritual when he's arguing for physical. See, that's kind of the problem with all of these arguments, right? Is the Corinthians kind of like had bits of truth in everything. He couldn't just say, that's completely wrong. He a lot of times had to like, especially with marriage and all those things, he's kind of like drawing this fine line of like, hey, it's good for you to be single, but also the things you're saying, you're whacked out and crazy, like all at the same time. And he does the same thing with their spiritualization of everything. He focuses a lot of time on the body and the physical, but he doesn't jettison what's spiritual. Instead, he tries to correct his opponents to see what is true spirituality. And he says, the true spiritual person is the one who receives the wisdom of God, the gospel that Paul preaches. And this person, along with everyone who's believed, has been baptized in the Spirit. Again, some of Paul's talk about spirit is like they're thinking they're kind of advanced beyond everyone else. And he's like, actually, when you just believe the gospel, you're spiritual. You are spiritual. On the other hand, the natural person doesn't receive God's wisdom. So in chapter 3, I mean, listen to this. It's like you can almost miss that Paul is just slamming these people. But in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 1, he says, but I, brothers, couldn't address you as spiritual people. He's like, you're not spiritual, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not with solid food, for you were not ready for it. And even now you are not ready for it. I mean, Paul is basically, again, he's trying to cut everything out from under them because he's trying to be like a good father, right? Sometimes as a good father, we have to like cut everything out that our kids are thinking when they're saying their stupid stuff. And we just got to say, no, that's wrong. Here's why you're wrong. The Corinthians saw themselves as spiritual, but in reality, they were natural because they weren't being transformed by the love of Jesus. So here's all this to say, man, this is a massive letter. It covers so much more than even what I just spoke about. I mean, there's so much in it. There's things in it that are hard to understand. And there's things in it that are really powerful. But my hope is that as we dive into this letter, our church is going to be transformed by the love of Jesus. And there's things in here that we're going to get to talk about, that we're going to get to dive into, that are things we don't always think about or talk about. And my hope is that our church is going to get a deeper, wider vision of who Jesus is through this. And so one of the things I just want to encourage you to do as kind of like a homework assignment out of this is I want you to read 1 Corinthians, but I want you to read it like as quickly as you can. What I mean by that is like, if you can read it in one sitting, do it. It takes about an hour. That's not that bad. It takes about an hour. If you need to do it in two sittings, that's fine. But literally in the last like couple weeks, I did that and it was like, wow. This is just so different than I thought. Like, I've read this letter so many times, but doing it in one full sitting, doing it just straight through, it changes the way that you actually see it. So, that's all I have. What questions do you guys have? Thoughts you guys have? Can open it up a few minutes. Always. Always.
Every time you land on a book and I do my one sitting, I'm like, oh, Lord.
I know. I think we go through and we're like, hey, let's pick the book that has head coverings in it and all that stuff. Oh, my gosh. Every time.
Calling called dibs on all the really hard passages.
Oh, great. Good. Can't wait.
It's gonna be like 40 weeks minimum. And I was like,
yep.
Yeah. we had our deacon cohort training last night, and we were kind of spending some time praying over each of the participants, and I shared with them that like as I've been praying about 1 Corinthians and moving into that season, I felt this anticipation of like who we're gonna get to preach on spiritual gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like in June.
I know, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So even thinking about like us as a team modeling what we know, like Paul was trying to help the Corinthians
mm-hmm.
practice. So, like,
so good.
What would it look like for the team from now through the end of this series to be the version of Corinthians that Paul wanted them to be the church as
yeah.
Jesus called it to be, to practice the gifts, to teach the gifts, to lay hands on people, to
yeah.
pray for the sick, to do the things of the church in a way that like re-stirs the passion and desire that we all had.
Mm. That's very good, Corey. Thank you.
Hey, Aaron.
Yeah.
What's, for those of us that want to dig a little deeper, what's one commentary or resource that you recommend for
them? My favorite one was Gordon Fee's. It's really thick. It's really thick and really dense. But he does a great job really with almost, I mean, there's some he does stupid things. But with most of the passages, he does a really good job, really thoughtful through it. I think if you're looking for something simpler, I mean, Andrew Wilson's stuff was fine. It's nice and simple. He has like a couple pages on each like section. And so it's not like a, it's not like a deep dive commentary really as much as it's just kind of like a, here's kind of just some thoughts through here. But I thought that that was, really helpful. But it's kind of one of those books that literally there are hundreds of commentaries on. So it's like, if you have an author you like or a commentary series you like, just look it up because it's probably there. But also, I am surprised. There are so many bad commentaries on 1 Corinthians. So let me just back that up with that. It's incredible. Like, I was shocked at how many commentaries I looked at that talked about prophecy being preaching or something equivalent, or saying to some weird whacked out stuff, like tongues being this feeling you get inside of you, that you like just, you know, feel things. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, anyway.
That's a good lead into my question. What is your commentary?
Yeah, no.
Are we posting recommended resources?
We are. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we'll have those on the website.
You guys can check that out and get as many of those as you want, and then you can send our quotes to those.
Yeah.
Aaron, I'm sorting through verses 10 to 17 this week.
Yeah.
And you said it in the beginning of your teaching about with the laundry list of things that are being addressed at this church, you made a comment, where do you begin?
Right? Yeah.
And I had kind of written that in my notes, like, it's interesting, where do you begin? But he begins here.
Yeah.
And I'm doing my own thinking about that, but I'm still, I don't know that I just find it interesting, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on why beginning with unity?
Yeah. No, that's good. I think, I don't know if this answers that question at all, but I'm just going to start talking about this, and then maybe I'll get to answer your question. So, one of the things I find interesting about that is it's like, it seems like the whole like first four chapters, there's a big thread of even him, like there's been some doubt about his own leadership and influence and authority among them. But it's fascinating that he doesn't start there. He starts with the different divisions that they have, which he's one of them. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't just start with like, hey, you guys should trust me and listen to me. Here's why. All this stuff. He gets there. He does that work. Yeah. But he starts with, you guys are divided. Yeah. Like, you guys are running after this and doing some of this and doing that. And I think some of it probably, if I had to guess why he's going there, is because if they're already discounting everything he's saying, then he's already lost the argument. So there's a part of him that's kind of like starting in that place of like, why should you even listen to me? Which starts in the earlier place of like, you guys are saying like, well, this is my guy, this is my guy, this is my guy. Yeah. And you're doing all of these things and basically just kind of white noising everyone else. And so I think it probably has something to do with that.
I try to do like five chapters a week, or every 2 weeks, five chapters a 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I kid you not, we got to chapter 11, it talks about head coverings. We talked about that passage for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And we realized like we literally have, like we didn't do anything but talk about this. We just understood what was going on.
Yeah.
So good luck for the days that.
Yeah.
Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin.
It's easy.
No brainer.